I think it's right to say that by having long hair, I am furthering patriarchal norms. It seems wrong and far too strong to say that, like, I have a duty not to.
You're listening to Wadcast, a podcast from Wadham College, University of Oxford, bringing you interviews, seminars, and stories from our community.
Welcome to episode 8. My name's Martin, I work in communications for Wadham College. In this episode, I talk to Cara Adelman, a Wadham student in her third year studying PPE. She won the college's Cheney Prize for her essay on the philosophy of social justice. Congratulations to Cara. We talk through the ideas and themes of her essay. Questions like, what does it take for us to be free people? And how should we think about our desires when those desires are formed by oppressive social structures? We'll dive in a moment, but before we roll the episode, be aware that at various points in the conversation, we do reference sexual assault and abuse. Thanks, Cara, for joining me today to discuss your essay and broader issues around philosophy and justice. Maybe you can start by just sharing a bit about who you are, what you do at Wadham, what you study, so on.
I'm Cara. I'm in my third year studying PPE, although economics was dropped a while ago now, so it feels like a bit of a distant memory. And yeah, outside of my degree, in the rare hours that are outside of my degree, I'm an SU women's officer with my friend Nia, more generally often with Nia and other PPEers and some others, kind of hold up in Wadham Library, or I go to SU yoga quite a lot.
So we're going to be talking about your Cheney Prize winning essay. The essay deals with issues of freedom and social justice, issues like what does it take for us to be free people? And you defend a particular theory of social justice. But before we get into the particulars of that theory, there might be some people listening who wonder, why theorise about social justice at all? Why not just go out and tackle it?
Easy question. I mean, I'm not going to try and make out that sort of my undergrad essay is somehow equivalent to like political protest or actually taking a more active stance on issues of injustice. And also, I guess, at the end of the day, a large part of the reason why I wrote the essay is just because I think it's quite interesting. But I'd like to think that it's not completely irrelevant either. I guess, specifically, this essay is kind of looking at cases where it seems like there's an injustice involved somewhere, but it's not actually obvious what that is and what is kind of responsible for the injustice. And so it's not clear what kind of just going out there and tackling it would look like if we didn't first think about why is this unjust, in what way is it unjust. So maybe it's of some value.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing I was thinking about as I read your essay is just that, as you pointed out, it's not always clear in a given case, A, whether there is injustice going on, or if there is, what is the source of the injustice, like what makes that particular event or interaction unjust. And so you kind of don't really know what tool to apply to something if you don't know what the problem is exactly. And maybe theorising can help us get a clearer grasp of what the problem is.
Maybe.
We'll see. Hopefully. But let's assume that we're on board for some theorising, at least for the purposes of a podcast. The particular theory of social justice you defend is called the Republican theory of social justice. Could you explain what that theory is and maybe clarify what Republican means in this context?
Yeah, so it's not US Republicanism, if that's the worry. So in this context, it's basically like a theory of social justice as obtaining where people have freedom in their interpersonal relationships, but freedoms understood in quite a specific way as not being dominated. Mm. So this idea of like freedom of non-domination, and domination occurs, so say A would dominate B if A has the capacity to interfere in B's choices in a way that B doesn't control.
So the Republican view doesn't require that we're never interfered with. It just requires that when we're interfered with, it's kind of on our terms. Is that right?
Yeah.
So can you explain a bit more about what the difference would be, maybe using an example between, you know, being interfered with not on your terms and being interfered with on your terms?
Yeah, so I'm going to say Philip Pettit. I always want to say Petit, but I might have his name wrong. But Philip Pettit, who sort of founded republicanism, has this quite famous example of like an alcohol cupboard case. So say you decide that you don't want to drink for the next week, and you lock all your alcohol in a cupboard and you give me the key and you're like, Cara, no matter what I say to you, don't give this back to me. If in 2 days' time you then come back and ask for the key and I say no, I'm interfering with your choices because I'm preventing you from choosing to go and drink. But I'm doing so on terms that you laid out. Basically, I'm doing it under your instructions. And so that interference would count as controlled for Pettit. And it has quite interesting implications in terms of like on a state level, because Pettit basically tries to argue that democracy counts as the citizens controlling the state's interference. If it's, good enough
right.
democracy at least.
Yeah, if it's sufficiently democratic.
Yeah. There definitely are cases in republicanism where you can interfere and that's not seen as like inhibiting anyone's freedom.
That's really interesting. Why do you prefer the republican theory over any other theory?
On the republican theory of justice, you're dominated if you're exposed to somebody's capacity to interfere with you. But because even if they don't actually interfere, but they just have the power to, essentially, that still counts as domination on a republican account. So it's quite different from, say, like liberalism in that sense, which focuses more purely on non-interference. And so long as people don't interfere with your choices, you're fine, you're free. Republicanism can capture, I think, more successfully cases where we feel like there's something unjust, but there isn't any actual interference. So I would say if you had a society where, say, like marital rape were legal and socially condoned, and so it's kind of structurally supported and it's not really punished, liberalism might see that as bad and it might say, hey, we should criminalise this and we should kind of socially sanction this. But its reason for doing so would just be that in cases where a wife were raped by her husband, she would be therefore interfered with. It's kind of a ridiculously academic way of talking about that, and that would be objectionable. Republicanism can kind of go one step further and say just the fact that he'd have the power to is objectionable in and of itself, and where he acts on that power, that's worse, and that's a kind of a greater injustice. But we should criminalise and socially sanction this, not just to try and minimise the chances or the probability of interference occurring, but because even if interference never occurred, just living under that power is objectionable.
Okay, great. That's really helpful. But what your essay deals with is a problem that the republican theory faces, like a particular objection. Can you explain what the problem is?
Yeah, so I kind of talk about it as like the problem from adaptive preferences. So adaptive preferences I am roughly defining as where the options that are available to someone are limited by their oppression, and so their preference is formed in response to their oppression. The sort of running example is where women have a sexual preference for their own subordination. But that preference is formed by patriarchal social conditioning. I think there are such sort of strong patriarchal conditioning into these roles that a lot of women do basically prefer subordination in various ways. So I mean, probably the stuff that comes to mind is like more kind of S&M type thing, but also it's a lot broader than that. It might also be kind of preference for a man to initiate a date rather than a woman, or a man to be the one that proposes rather than the woman. So I think it's actually quite widespread.
Right. Okay, yeah, so we have these adaptive preferences, the concept of them, preferences that are genuine preferences of the person who has them, but nonetheless they have been shaped by oppressive social structures. So why do these adaptive preferences cause a problem for the Republican theory of justice?
So because, like I spoke about earlier, on the Republican theory of justice, interference is only problematic, it only counts as dominating if it's not controlled by the person. There'll be lots of cases where adaptive preferences might lead someone to prefer and then say consent to or initiate interferences, say a particular sexual act, where they might not have consented to it if it weren't for having adaptive preferences, but nonetheless they do consent, and intuitively that seems like a case where they control that interference, just like in the alcohol cupboard case. And so that's not necessarily the wrong, well, I'm going to argue it's not the wrong verdict, but it does seem to suggest that republicanism just has nothing to say about what's unjust in, for example, women choosing to be sexually subordinate or people acting on their adaptive preferences more generally.
Yeah, so if I'm following then, when we look at a case of an adaptive preference at work, like a woman preferring to be sexually submissive and consenting to sexual acts that put her in that submissive position, there seems to be, intuitively, there's something unjust like around this territory. But it seems, at least on first glance, that the Republican theory cannot capture or say anything about that injustice, because it seems like in the details of the case, the conditions for a just or free relationship are satisfied. You know, like the person is acting with a genuine desire, and you know, if they're consenting to a sexual act that puts them in a submissive position, yeah, they're being interfered with, but it's on the basis of their genuine preferences. And so we have a situation where intuitively we still want to say there's something unjust about this. After all, the preferences are kind of formed by these oppressive structures, but it's not clear what the Republican view can actually say about that injustice.
Yeah.
So, okay.
You're summarising this far more eloquently than I'm saying it in the first place. But yeah, that's exactly it.
Cool. You want to defend the Republican view from this objection. You think that there is like a good way of critiquing the objection, but there's also a way to respond that you don't think is ultimately successful.
Yeah.
So what's the wrong way to defend the Republican view?
So I think the wrong way is to try and argue that acting on adaptive preferences and any interference consented to based on them actually is unjust on a Republican account. So you could try and kind of push back against this idea that consent equals control and sort of say, actually, where consent's based on adaptive preferences, it doesn't, and therefore, because it would be uncontrolled interference, it would be domination, it would be unjust.
Right. So, sorry to jump in, so you're saying that, according to this response, if you're consenting to something on the basis of your adaptive preferences, it's not really on your terms?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would be exactly it. You'd have to try and argue that it's not really the agent's true choice. Yeah, so I think that this response is quite problematic, because on the face of it, there just clearly are cases where consent does control the interference. So like the cases we were just speaking about, where someone consents to submissive sexual acts, but say, you know, their partner wouldn't do that unless they were to consent. It seems pretty clear there that they do control it. And so to try and argue that even in such cases, it's actually not the agent, but instead kind of the social structures which are shaping their preferences, that controls the interference, denies the agency of the person involved, kind of denies the fact that from the inside it still feels just like their preferences and they're choosing to act on them, and also seems to kind of elide the distinction between someone consenting to an interference where their consent's based on adaptive preferences and someone just not consenting, because either way it would be the patriarchal social structures which give their sexual partner that capacity to interfere rather than their choice or their consent. And I think that hopefully it's obvious that those are two like very different cases.
Yeah, no, that seems right. So let's grant that that's not like a very promising avenue for defending republicanism. What is a more promising route?
So I think, and try to argue, not so sure if I succeed on this one, that republicanism can still say that there is an injustice involved. It's not sort of left with nothing to say, by recognising that when adaptive preferences are formed, that formation itself is dominating. And so even then, if people go on to choose X, Y, Z on the basis of those preferences, that need not constitute domination. That is still domination, and therefore kind of a republican idea of injustice involved.
Yeah, so that sounds like what initially motivated this problem was that intuitively there's something unjust in this like territory, roughly. And you're saying, okay, what the republican can do is say, we shouldn't locate the injustice in like a particular act of consent. So it shouldn't, we shouldn't locate the injustice when, for instance, a woman via her adaptive preferences consents to a sexually submissive act. Where we should locate the injustice, and so say there's something right about our intuitions, is in the fact that those adaptive preferences were formed in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay. You said you're not 100% sure that your response succeeds. What are the concerns that you have about it?
So, kind of up until now, and like at the beginning when I was explaining what domination is, it's sort of this idea that person A dominates person B when they have this capacity for uncontrolled interference. And where adaptive preferences are formed, it might not be that there is any person A who dominates. So it might be that, you know, there's the agent, and just through kind of seemingly or ostensibly innocuous like social structures, like the way that we're brought up, the kind of films that we see, books that we read, all present it as such that, you know, women ought to be more passive and men ought to be more active and dominant. And so thereby this person acquires adaptive preferences. It's not very obvious here that there's anyone in particular who dominates her. So to explain how it is still domination, I think we need to have this concept of systemic domination, which is the idea that someone can be dominated because they are systematically disempowered relative to other agents, even if there aren't any other agents that are actually doing the dominating. And I think that this does work as a response in saying that the formation of adaptive preferences is unjust. What I'm less sure about is whether it remains unjust because it involves domination, or whether it kind of collapses into maybe another thing like oppression.
Right, that's interesting. Yeah, so yeah, the concern here is that what started off as an account that framed injustice as a relationship between two people, two persons, now to maintain your response, you kind of have to say that injustice can occur between a person and this sort of slightly more like diffuse group of people, or where no one agent bears the full brunt of any responsibility, but they all kind of participate slightly in some diffuse way.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think is a good thing, insofar as I think that much more accurately captures how injustice is sort of perpetrated a lot of the time, or kind of how it permeates through society. But I guess the worry would be that what made domination this like distinct concept in the first place was this idea of a kind of paradigm like master-slave relationship, where there's someone kind of imposing their will on somebody else. So I don't think that it's like a flaw of a theory of social justice to focus on like the diffuse ways that kind of power can be exercised over people, but it might just be that I kind of fail to vindicate republicanism as that theory.
Right, like maybe the theory has transformed into a different theory.
Maybe. I'm still hoping not. But
yeah. No, that is interesting. And one of the things that you address in the longer form of your essay, which I've read, is an objection or a concern that I had upon like second read of your essay, and then you addressed what I was concerned about, so well done on that. I was thinking, yeah, but you know, none of our preferences are entirely free from social control. So it has to be, what makes the formation of an adaptive preference unjust has to be more than just that the person didn't autonomously create them in some like social void. It has to be something distinct from that. So I think you appealed to some particular criteria that make, you know, adaptive preferences, the formation of them an injustice, but not some other preferences.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly what you were saying. I mean, basically all of our preferences are influenced by our social conditions. I mean, I think I mentioned earlier, like, say, someone who votes based on what their parents vote on, or yeah, if my music taste is influenced by the kind of music that my friends listen to, that kind of thing. Yeah, so there are cases like that where it's very obvious that social conditioning is involved, but we very much wouldn't want to say that that makes the person kind of dominated, or that that constitutes kind of social injustice. I think we can differentiate cases of adaptive preference formation from this kind of more innocuous preference formation, because where adaptive preferences are formed, it is the case that the person who forms their adaptive preferences is kind of systematically disempowered relative to another group that's empowered by their having that preference. And so, to kind of give an example, if a woman forms a preference for sexual subordination, kind of indirectly, we could say that that empowers men because it's feeding into patriarchal norms where women are submissive, and those norms privilege men. And so there's a sense in which, by her forming adaptive preferences, not only is she not in control of her preference formation, but also others are kind of given power relative to her.
So yeah, the idea is that adaptive preferences, unlike some other more innocuous kinds of preferences formed by society, are that these are ones which end up giving one group power over another. Or am I misconstruing that?
That is what I just said, but I'm just debating whether or not that's what I want to have said.
Okay, right, sure.
So I think what I want to try and argue is that, kind of regardless of the consequences, in the very process of adaptive preference formation, one group is empowered relative to the person whose preferences are, and potentially their social group, who are disempowered. So
I see.
In the essay, I tried to use this this idea of objectification, which is, I mean, it's Sally Hasslanger's definition, and it's quite technical. But basically, the idea is that if one group of persons has like social power over another, then the way that they want someone to be might force that person to actually become that way. So I think the quote is something along the lines of, like, men wanting women to be subordinate forces them to become subordinate. And I think that with a suitably like loose understanding of what we mean by force here, I think that it is actually quite plausible that the fact that it's benefited men for women to be submissive and for men to have more power relative to them has meant that we have masses of media in which that is kind of romanticised or eroticised or promoted, and therefore people's preferences are kind of formed according to that. And it's the case that men's preferences are also formed according to that, but in such a case it's like the way that men want, the idea would be men wanting men to be dominant causes men to become dominant.
Yeah.
Whereas if that's the sort of parallel quote, so there's not the same like disempowerment relative to another group that there would be in the case of men and women to be subordinate forces women to become subordinate.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. We're definitely going to have to explain like some relevant difference between the formation of adaptive preferences and just any other preferences. And what you described strikes me as as good a way as any to make that distinction. I think in my mind, it returns a little bit to the worry that you had that maybe at the end of this, you get a really great theory of justice, but it's just not the Republican one. But yeah, the reason I say that, my concern is that according to the Republican theory of justice, you know, what can make something unjust is this interference with another agent not on their terms. And that might be fine, like that might be sufficient to make something unjust. But it's not clear now that that's necessary, just because in the case of adaptive preference formation, it seems like what we're appealing to now is something a little different, something like power exertion, where we're no longer talking about terms, whether it's on anyone's terms. I could be entirely mistaken.
No, I feel like that's a good point. I will try and, like, push back.
Yeah, I do.
So for republicanism, it's sort of always about power insofar as it's the capacity for uncontrolled interference that's problematic. And I think that it is relevant in the case of adaptive preference formation that it's not on the person's terms. So if it were the case that I could, like, consent to how my preferences are formed, and thereby determine the conditions on which my preferences were formed, if I could sort of say, oh yeah, I am really happy to be influenced by patriarchal structures such that I prefer to have long hair, then I could say, well, nothing's interfered with me in a way that I haven't controlled. I think that because our preferences dictate what we choose in the first place, it's just not intelligible that we could control the way that our preferences are formed by, say, patriarchal structures. So I think that that still is doing some work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful, actually. I think I follow that. I think the mistake I was making was in thinking that, okay, because, like, necessarily you aren't sort of consenting to your preference formation, that your lack of consent was morally irrelevant in that case. On the Republican theory, you kind of need, like, two things. You need some, like, interference, so some kind of exercise of power, say, and you need for that to not be on your terms, for that to be addressed. Or am I...
The only mistake is that you don't need there to be any actual exercise of the power.
Oh, right, the capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, true. When it comes to adaptive preferences, they are necessarily subject to the not on your terms condition, in the same way that any desires which are formed by societal influences satisfy that condition. So that condition is, like, almost trivially satisfied. But in the case of adaptive preferences and not more innocuous preferences, you also get this capacity or exercise of power over you. All that to say, I think your response succeeds to my worry. So
you sound good. More confident than I am, but that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that summed it up helpfully, actually.
Cool. Well, let's tie things together. What does all this show us about justice more broadly?
Scary question. I think it raises some quite interesting questions about, like, the extent of our responsibility to combat injustice. Like, I think on the face of it, we'd want to say that wherever we're responsible for perpetuating injustice, we ought not to do that and we ought to act differently. But once we see, that's a very confident way of assuming my argument works, if we see that the formation of adaptive preferences is unjust, then there are so many kind of small and seemingly harmless ways that we all contribute to forming one another's adaptive preferences all the time. Like I mentioned earlier, if I have long hair, like if I have a daughter and I'm wearing makeup and have my hair long, then that might reinforce to her that that's how a woman ought to dress, and that kind of then perpetuates patriarchal norms. And so I think it's right to say that by having long hair, I am furthering patriarchal norms. It seems wrong and far too strong to say that, like, I have a duty not to.
How dare you?
So yeah. I think there's, like, some interesting questions there about kind of more broadly, do our actions have to be harmful in order for us to have a duty not to act in that way? Or where we kind of contribute to injustice in, like, more subtle ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's our responsibility for not doing that, basically?
Right. No, that's, really good question. And to end on a lighter note, what's your favourite thing about Wadham?
The people, can I say that?
All my friends. You absolutely can.
And, the lovely people of Wadham.
Wonderful answer. And, if people want to get in touch with you, either to chat about your ideas or to reach out to you in your role as women's officer in the SU, how is best for them to do that?
probably email me. I mean, my WADM email is just my name, or if it was about SU Women stuff, there's an SU.women email. Yeah?
Sure, I'll include your email in the show notes.
Great.
And congratulations again on winning the essay prize. And
thank you
for sharing it with the WADM community. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. If you have any comments or feedback about WADcast, we'd love to hear from you and continue improving the show. You can leave your feedback by heading to www.wadham.ox.ac.uk/wadcast. Bye for now.